Krishna book for the next few mornings. And back in the old days, we used to, before we read the Krishna book, we would chant this mantra that's found in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhulila, chapter 7, text 96. Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 Rakshamam. Krishna, 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 Pahimam. Rama, Raghava, Rama, Raghava, Rama, Raghava, Rakshamam. Krishna, Keshava, Krishna, Keshava, Krishna, Keshava, Pahimam. Basically, it means Krishna, protect me, Krishna, maintain me, like that. Nice. Lord Chaitanya used to chant that mantra as he was walking along the roads when he was going from one place to another on those years he was traveling and preaching. It said that aside from the Hare Krishna mantra, sometimes Lord Chaitanya would be chanting that mantra as he was walking along. And Prabhupada has that right at the very beginning of the introduction here to the Krishna book. So, just a little something about the Krishna book, since we're going to be reading from this. Prabhupada gave us the Krishna book way back in 1970, and the little history that I know about it is that Prabhupada was concerned that he wouldn't finish he wouldn't get to the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, he felt like maybe he wouldn't live that long, and he was concerned that he didn't want his disciples and the devotees and years to come to not have the pastimes of Krishna. So he stopped his work on translating the Srimad Bhagavatam or whatever he was working on at that time. It was way back in 1970, and he did the Krishna book, and it came out, I think, right in the beginning of 1970. Yeah, it came out February 26, 1970 is when he completed it, which was actually the appearance day of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, his spiritual master. So throughout 1969, Prabhupada was working on the Krishna book. And he felt it was a very important literature. He made, I think it's the end of it, at the end of the introduction, Prabhupada at the end of his preface, Prabhupada gave a preface and an introduction to the Krishna book. And towards the end of the preface, he made a couple of comments about the importance of the Krishna book. He said that this transcendental work of literature is published with profuse illustrations. And he said, people love to read various kinds of fiction to spend their time and energy. Now this tendency can be directed towards Krishna. And he said, the result will be imperishable satisfaction of the soul, both individually and collectively. And then right in the third to last paragraph, he said, one will find that by reading one page after another, an immense treasure of knowledge in art, science, literature, philosophy, and religion will be revealed. And ultimately, by reading this one book, Krishna, love of God will fructify. That's a nice meditation. So we're about two days away from the appearance day of Lord Krishna. So nice program might be if you haven't already done so, or even if you've done so, you could start a reading of the Krishna book and, coinciding with now Krishna Janmashtami, the appearance of Krishna, and read it straight through. You know, start your Krishna period, and you're starting your reading of the Krishna book right at this time, and hopefully by the time you're finished, love of Godhead will fructify in your life, if it hasn't already. But this is actually very potent stuff. What to speak of this Krishna book, even the name Krishna. There was one devotee, I was traveling for the last couple months, and I was traveling with a group of devotees. We were following a concert tour around the country, and there was one devotee, his technique for distributing was that, he's like, I never saw this before. He'd walk up to people, and he'd go, Krishna. He'd point above their head, and he'd go, Krishna. And they're just kind of like, what? What? And then he'd go, this is cool stuff. Hand them the book. He said, this is cool stuff. Check it out. And they go, okay. And the next thing they have a book in their hand. So everybody gives a donation. Can you give a donation to help out? And they go, well, what is it? What is it about? And he said, it's pure love of God. Sometimes he said yoga meditation, but a lot of time he was just saying pure love of God. And that devotee, his name is Krishna Kumar, he's a brahmachari in San Diego. One day he did 400 science of self-realizations. That was his line. Krishna. And really? Krishna. And they'd stop and look, what? And he'd, this is cool stuff, check it out. And they go, okay. And then he just told everybody gives a donation. Can you give a donation to help? But what is it? What is it? Pure love of God. Just goes to show you. Purity is the force. And actually, in 1975, Prabhupada met with the book distributors in Atlanta. And it was one of the only meetings. And the spokesman for the book distributors said to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, sometimes when we go to the temples, they ask us to give class in book distribution technique. And Prabhupada said, so, you know, what do you tell them? And he said, well, we tell them first they have to read the books and follow the regulative principles. And he was kind of, and Prabhupada interrupted him and said, yes, that is our only technique, to be very devout followers of the rules and regulations. In other words, there's no, like, purity is the force. It's not the lines you use, really. It's like, you know, it's being, as Prabhupada said, devout followers of the rules and regulations, and that's where the enthusiasm comes from, and then you just, that just spills over, and the people pick up on the fact that, wow, this is, something's gotten as far out as going on here. Let me get in on this. So anyway, that's my understanding of how that worked. So we're going to be reading from the first chapter, and it's entitled The Advent of Lord Krishna. Chapter 1. Once the world was overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings, who were actually demons, but were posing themselves as the royal order. At that time, the whole world became perturbed, and the predominating deity of this earth, known as Bhumi, went to see Lord Brahma to tell of her calamities due to the demoniac kings. Bhumi assumed the shape of a cow and presented herself before Lord Brahma with tears in her eyes. She was bereaved and was weeping just to invoke the Lord's compassion. She related the calamitous position of the earth. And after hearing this, Lord Brahma became much aggrieved, and he at once started for the ocean of milk, where Lord Vishnu resides. Lord Brahma was accompanied by all the demigods headed by Lord Shiva, and Bhumi also followed. Arriving on the shore of the ocean of milk, Lord Brahma began to pacify Lord Vishnu, who had formerly saved the earth, formerly saved the earthly planet by assuming the transcendental form of a boar. So I'll just make one more comment, and then after that I'll read. But so there's some similarities here to the present-day world situation. The very first sense is, once the world was overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings, who were actually demons, but were posing themselves as the royal order. So I'd like to suggest that the exact same thing is happening today. Exact same thing. It's no different. The world is overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings, leaders, political leaders. They're actually demons, and they're posing themselves as leaders, but really they're demons. And the last sentence Prabhupada says here refers to how Lord Vishnu had formerly saved the earthly planet by assuming the transcendental form of a boar, and now Lord Krishna is saving the earthly planet by assuming the transcendental form of a name. You know, Kali, Nama, Rupa, Krishna avatar. It's stated that Krishna is present now in the Kali Yuga in the form of his name. The holy name is non-different from Krishna. And that saving, it says here, he saved the earthly planet by assuming that transcendental form of the boar. And that same saving is going on. It's going on. In Prabhupada's purport to in the Bhagavad Gita to the chapter 4 text 8, Prabhupada says, the devotees of Lord Krishna are very much attracted by the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya. This avatar of the Lord does not kill the miscreants, but delivers them by his causeless mercy. Okay? So the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya is here, it's in full swing, and it is delivering miscreants, what to speak of pious people, it's delivering miscreants due to the causeless mercy of Lord Chaitanya. And we can see that's, you know, happening Even now, right now, and you know, here in the United States, here in America, we on this trip I was making, we were distributing on the average of about 1,000 hardback books a day. Well, not hardback, but big and maha big books. We weren't doing the hardbacks. We were doing like the paperbacks because they're smaller and can carry more of them. But we were doing like a combination of like big and maha big books, which means soft cover Bhagavad Gitas and Journey to Self-Discovery, Science of Self-Realization, Hard and Soft, about 1,000 a day for 40 shows. That's 40,000 books. And, you know, there's plenty of people out there that are really interested to get these books. And I was throughout the trip, I was meeting a lot of people who already had them. They got them at their schools or other places, but a lot of kids at schools who had them, who were reading them, and who were appreciating them, and they expressed as much. So that was interesting. And this year, for the first time, we had I don't think I mentioned when I spoke last time, because it hadn't happened yet, we had a tent inside the actual festival itself. And it was like, up till this, all the years previous to this, we were just distributing books to the people as they were arriving in their car. Then we'd go inside and walk around and distribute on the inside, and then kind of sometimes get them as they're leaving. But this year we actually had a tent in there. We were only one tent out of maybe 200, and aside from the five stages that they were. But, you know, it was significant because there were six devotees who were part of that team, and one of them was sitting just, you know, on a mat there with a microphone, and they'd call the kids in. They'd get about six to a dozen kids sitting down, and then they'd kind of give them they'd preach to them a little bit, just for 2 or 3 minutes, tell them about, you know, the holy name and whatever the philosophy is, as they thought they could understand it. They'd get the kids chanting. The kids would all chant, at least, you know, the ones that were there. And some of them were really enthusiastic and were really, like, you could see they were into it. Then whoever was, they'd look for that kid who was the most enthusiastic. Then they'd get him or her to lead the chanting for everybody else. And then all the ones that wanted, they'd give them neck beads. They gave them a set of japa beads, neem japa beads. They must have brought a crate over from India, because we were giving out, like, you know, dozens of them every day. And the kids would, you know, take it, and some of the kids would, they teach them how to chant, and some of the kids were taking it seriously, and you see them walking around the Warped Tour all day long with the beads around their neck. And they had books there. Some kids would take the, you know, Bhagavad Gita and give a donation as well. And next year they're going to try to they've already talked to the festival organizers, who like us. The man who owns the whole thing is, I wouldn't say he's a devotee, but he's like incredibly favorably, considering that he's just a businessman and, you know, a music businessman. But he said we could have a bigger area, and next year they're going to try to get the kids not just chanting but dancing. And we're working on getting permission to distribute prasadam for free, because we can't compete with the venues. That's how they make all their money. But we're thinking of like maybe distributing some halava or something like that. So it could be really great. Could develop into something really, even much more significant than it was even this year. So that was very nice. And we could see that just on this point of how, you know, people, there are definitely people out there who are receptive, who are really, you know, ready and waiting for this message. I had one experience. Well, actually, just before I get on to that, you know, that, of course, that's our philosophy. Our philosophy is that ultimately everybody is a devotee of Krishna. There's that first Nitya Siddha, Krishna Premi, Sabha Kabanaya, Shravanadi Sutichite, Kori Udaya, that pure love for Krishna is lying dormant within the heart of every living entity. It just has to be awakened by the process of hearing and chanting. But the thing is, some living entities are more ready than others. We observe that, and that's also our philosophy, because in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, he's talking to Arjuna, he says, O son of Prita, in this world there are two kinds of created beings. One is called divine and the other demoniac. And then he goes on to explain. He said, I've already explained to you about the divine nature, now I'll tell you about the demoniac. So this, you know, it's true. Everybody ultimately is a devotee of Krishna, you know, as per that verse. But there are some people that are a bit closer to maybe being able to take advantage of that in this lifetime, and those are the ones, that's what's being referred to here in this other verse, is the divine and the demoniac nature. And you can really see that. You can see it, how, like, when you go out and preach, how some people just, You don't even have to make any effort. They basically see you and they just come over. They don't even know what you got. You can be standing there holding the book, and they just kind of like their eyes hit you, and they're drawn in. And there's other people who you could be like right in their face, and they just. So you know, there's Vaisheshika Prabhu gave a really nice analogy. Two or three years ago, he was giving one of these seminars that went on the Prabhupada festival days, I think it was, Prabhupada Memorial Weekend. And he was saying that a Sankirtan devotee has to be like an orchardist. You know, the orchardist, he goes out there to get his fruit, you know, when it's the seasons, when the time is right. And he tries to go for the ripe fruit. You know, he doesn't pick up all the stuff on the ground that's already fallen off the tree because it's, you know, partially rotten already. I lived in New Zealand for about 5 years, and I know this is actually how it works. Once that fruit hits the ground, they don't bother with it. They used to let us come around, and we could collect as much fruit as we want that was already on the ground. Because maybe there might be a worm in it or this or that, or whatever. So once it's on the ground, they don't touch it. And even on the tree, they just go for the fruit that's ripe, that you can just kind of go, boop, and it comes right off. That's the mantra, by the way, boop. And there's no point in going for the unripe fruit because you got to pull it. And, you know, it's like a whole big battle. And even once you get it off, what do you got? A piece of unripe fruit. It doesn't taste right. You know, it's unripe. You got to leave it just to sit around for a long time. But we're just going for the ripe fruit. So he was suggesting that should be the mentality of a preacher, of a Sankirtan devotee. Just go out there. We're just trying to meet the ripe fruit. There's people that are ripe. And it's a fact. It's a fact. You know, I had one kid who was really far out. He was, I don't know, I guess he was about 8 or 9 years old. It was hard for me to tell how old he was. He was kind of short, you know. Maybe he was 10. And he was there with his sister, a brother, and his mother and father. So I approached the whole family. And I said, hey, you know, hi folks, thanks for coming to Warped Tour. You guys look like you're having a great time out here. You all look really happy. And the rest of them, and he said, this one kid, and I said, here, please have a look at this. And I handed out, I just held the book out. And he grabbed at it, you know. And then his sister started going, no, give it back, give it back. He says, no, this looks far out, looks interesting. He says, he asked me, what's going on? I said, well, we just asked for a donation. And so his sister and his brother, and they're both going, no, give it back, give it back. And he goes, no, why? It looks interesting. And basically this kid had fought off his whole family, you know. He says, no, it looks interesting. And he says, no, just give it back, come on, let's go. And he says, why? No. He says he wants money. He wants money. He says, well, no. He says, but he's just asking for a donation. And then he looked back at me, right? You're just asking for a donation, right? I said, yeah. He says, yeah, but he wants money. He says, no, but how much? And he says, well, whatever you like to give is okay. And then his parents, you know, the kids, this brother and sister looked over at the parents and said, hey, can you tell him? Let's go. And the parents went, give it back. He said, well, and he looked at them and he said, no, Mom, it looks interesting. He's just asking for a donation. Anyway, basically, this kid fought off his whole family. And they finally had to give him a dollar. He only gave me a dollar, but I decided I'm going to give this kid the book if he gives me a penny. And I was just like, such a, you know, amazing kid. He had opposition from his mother, his father, his brothers and brother and sister, but, you know, he's wanted that book. So in other words, he was a ripe fruit, in other words. There's so many people out there like that. You know, sometimes you see kids, they're like among a whole group of friends, and the whole group of friends is going like, no, come on, let's go. They're practically dragging them. Their friends are practically trying to drag them away, and they go, no, hey, come on, no, leave me, no, this looks cool, I want to check this out. That's it. You know, so that's, we have to remember that there's people out there that are ready and waiting for Krishna consciousness, and we just basically have to go out there and meet them, you know? And then bring them in and pick them and bring them back into the association of the devotees, which is where they belong, which is where they're meant to be in this lifetime. So anyway, so now I'll read. Okay, so in the Vedic mantras, there is a particular type of prayer called Purusha Shukta. Generally, the demigods offer their obeisances unto Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by chanting the Purusha Shukta. It is understood herein that the predominating deity of every planet can see the Supreme Lord of this universe, Brahma, whenever there is some disturbance on his planet. And Brahma can approach the Supreme Lord Vishnu, not by seeing him directly, but by standing on the shore of the ocean of milk. There is a planet within this universe called Svetadvip, and on that planet there is an ocean of milk. It is understood from various Vedic literatures that just as there is the ocean of salt water on this planet, there are various kinds of oceans on other planets. Somewhere there is an ocean of milk, and somewhere there is an ocean of oil. Somewhere there are oceans of liquor and of many other types of liquids. The Purusha Shukta is the standard prayer which the demigods recite to appease the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Shiradakshai Vishnu. Because he is lying on the ocean of milk, he is called Shiradakshai Vishnu. He is the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead through whom all the incarnations within this universe appear. Prabhupada doesn't mention it, but I think Shira is milk, right? Or Shira, yeah. Shiradakshai Vishnu. Something to do with milk. He says he's on the ocean of milk, and that name actually has something to do with the milk. After all the demigods offered the Purusha Shukta prayer to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they apparently heard no response. Then Lord Brahma personally sat in meditation, and there was a message transmission from Lord Vishnu to Brahma. Brahma then broadcast the message to the demigods. That is the system of receiving Vedic knowledge. The Vedic knowledge is received first by Brahma from the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the medium of the heart. As stated in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Tene Brahma Rudha Yadadi Kavaye, the transcendental knowledge of the Vedas was transmitted to Lord Brahma through the heart. Here also, in the same way, only Brahma could understand the message transmitted by Lord Vishnu. And he broadcast it to the demigods for their immediate action. The message was this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead would appear on earth very soon, along with his supreme powerful potencies. And as long as he remained on earth, on the earth planet, to execute his mission of annihilating the demons and establishing the devotees, the demigods should also remain there to assist him. They should all immediately take birth in the family of the Yadu dynasty, wherein the Lord would appear in due course of time. The Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, Krishna, would personally appear as the son of Vasudev. Before his appearance, all the demigods, along with their wives, should appear in different pious families in the world just to assist the Lord in executing his mission. The exact words used here are tat priyartam, which means the demigods should appear on the earth in order to please the Lord. In other words, any living entity who lives only to satisfy the Lord is a demigod. The demigods were further informed that Ananta, the plenary portion of Lord Krishna, who is maintaining the universal planets by extending his millions of hoods, would also appear on earth before Lord Krishna's appearance. They were also informed that the external potency of Vishnu, Maya, with whom all the conditioned souls are enamored, would also appear by the order of the Supreme Lord just to execute his purpose. After instructing and pacifying all the demigods, as well as Bhumi, with sweet words, Lord Brahma, the father of all Prajapatis, or progenitors of the universal population, departed for his own abode, the highest material planet called Brahmaloka. The leaders of the Yadu dynasty, King Surasena, the leader of the Yadu dynasty, King Surasena, was ruling over the country known as Mathura, wherein lies the city of Mathura, as well as the districts of Surasena, which was named after him. On account of the rule of King Surasena, Mathura became the capital city of all the kings of the Yadus. Mathura was also made the capital of the kings of the Yadu dynasty, because the Yadus were a very pious family and knew that Mathura is a place where Lord Sri Krishna lives eternally, just as he also lives in Dwarka. Once upon a time, Vasudev, the son of Surasena, just after marrying Devaki, was going home on his chariot with his newly wedded wife. The father of Devaki, known as Devaka, had contributed a sufficient dowry because he was very affectionate toward his daughter. He had contributed hundreds of chariots completely decorated with gold equipment. At that time, Kamsa, the son of Ugrasena, in order to please his sister Devaki, had voluntarily taken the reins of the horses of Vasudev's chariot and was driving. According to the custom of the Vedic civilization, when a girl is married, the brother takes the sister and brother-in-law to their home. Because the newly married girl may feel too much separation from her father's family, the brother goes with her until she reaches her father-in-law's house. The full dowry contributed by Devaka was as follows: 400 elephants, fully decorated with golden garlands, 15,000 decorated horses, 1,800 fully decorated, 1,800 chariots. He also arranged for 200 beautiful girls to follow his daughter. The Kshatriya system of marriage, still current in India, dictates that when a Kshatriya is married, a few dozen of the bride's young girlfriends, in addition to the bride, go to the house of the king. The followers of the queen are called maidservants, but actually they act as friends of the queen. This practice is prevalent from time immemorial, traceable at least to the time before the advent of Lord Krishna, 5,000 years ago. So Vasudev brought home another 200 beautiful girls, along with his wife Devaki. Did any of our devotees experience that when they got married? No. Prabhupada says it's still current to this day, but anyway, maybe in some remote parts of India. While the bride and bridegroom were passing along on the chariot, there were different kinds of musical instruments playing to indicate the auspicious moment. There were conch shells, bugles, drums, kettle drums combined together, and they were vibrating a nice concert. The procession was passing very pleasingly, and Kamsa was driving the chariot when suddenly there was a miraculous sound vibrated from the sky, which especially announced to Kamsa, "Kamsa, you are such a fool. You are driving the chariot of your sister and your brother-in-law, but you do not know that the eighth child of this sister will kill you." Kamsa was the son of Ugrasena and of the Bhoja dynasty. It is said that Kamsa was the most demoniac of all the Bhoja dynasty kings. Immediately after hearing the prophecy from the sky, he caught hold of Devaki's hair and was just about to kill her with his sword. Vasudeva was astonished at Kamsa's behavior, and in order to pacify the cruel, shameless brother-in-law, he began to speak as follows, with great reason and evidence. He said, "My dear brother-in-law, Kamsa, you are the most famous king of the Bhoja dynasty, and people know that you are the greatest warrior and a valiant king. How is it that you are so infuriated that you are prepared to kill a woman, who is your own sister, at this auspicious time of her marriage? Why should you be so much afraid of death? Death is already born along with your birth. From the very day you took your birth, you began to die. Suppose you are 25 years old. That means you have already died 25 years. Every moment, every second, you are dying. Why then should you be so much afraid of death? Final death is inevitable. You may die today, either today or in 100 years. You cannot avoid death. Why should you be so much afraid? Actually, death means annihilation of the present body. As soon as the present body stops functioning and mixes with the five elements of the material nature, the living entity within the body accepts another body, according to his present actions and reactions. It is just like when a man walks on the street. He puts forward his foot, and when he is confident that his foot is situated on the ground, he lifts the other foot. In this way, one after another, the body changes and the soul transmigrates. See how the plant worm changes from one twig to another so carefully. Similarly, the living entity changes his body as soon as the higher authorities decide on his next body. As long as the living entity is conditioned within this material world, he must take material bodies one after another. His next particular body is offered by the laws of nature, according to the actions and reactions of this life. Now, Vasudev continues. This body is exactly like one of the bodies which we see in a dream. During our dream of sleep, we create so many bodies according to mental creation. We have seen gold, and we have also seen a mountain. So in a dream, we can see a golden mountain by combining the two ideas. Sometimes in dreams, we see that we have a body which is flying in the sky. And at that time, we completely forget our present body. Similarly, these bodies are changing. When you have one body, you forget the past body. During a dream, you may make contact with so many new kinds of bodies. But when we are awake, we forget them all. And actually, these material bodies are the creations of our mental activities. But at the present moment, we do not recollect our past bodies. Vasudev continues, "The nature of the mind is flickering. Sometimes it accepts something and immediately it rejects the same thing. Accepting and rejecting is the process of the mind in contact with the five objects of sense gratification: form, taste, smell, sound, and touch. In its speculative way, the mind comes in touch with the objects of sense gratification, and when the living entity desires a particular type of body, he gets it. Therefore, the body is an offering by the laws of material nature. The living entity accepts a body and comes out again into the material world to enjoy or suffer according to the construction of the body. Unless we have a particular type of body, we cannot enjoy or suffer according to our mental proclivities inherited from the previous life. The particular type of body is actually offered to us according to our mental condition at the time of death. Vasudev continues. The luminous planets like the sun, moon, and stars reflect themselves in different types of reservoirs like water, oil, or ghee. The reflection moves according to the movement of the reservoir. The reflection of the moon is on the water, and the moving water makes the moon also appear to be moving. But actually, the moon is not moving. Similarly, by mental concoction, the living entity attains different kinds of bodies, although actually he has no connection with such bodies. But on account of illusion, being enchanted by the influence of Maya, the living entity thinks that he belongs to a particular type of body. That is the way of conditioned life. Suppose the living entity is now in a human form of body. He thinks that he belongs to the human community, or a particular country, or a particular place. He identifies himself in that way and unnecessarily prepares for another body, which is not required by him. Such desires and mental concoctions are the cause of different types of bodies. The covering influence of the material nature is so strong that the living entity is satisfied in whatever body he gets, and he identifies with that body with great pleasure. Therefore I request you, not to be overwhelmed by the dictation of your mind and body. Vasudev thus requested Kamsa not to be envious of his newly married sister. One should not be envious of anyone, because envy is the cause of fear both in this life, both in this world and in the next. When one is before Yamaraj, the lord of the punishment after death, Vasudev appealed to Kamsa on behalf of Devaki, stating that she was his younger sister. He also appealed at an auspicious moment, at the time of marriage. A younger sister or brother is supposed to be protected as one's child. Quote, the position is overall so delicate, Vasudev reasoned, that if you kill her, it will go against your high reputation. In this way, Vasudev tried to pacify Kamsa by good instruction as well as by philosophical discrimination. But Kamsa was not to be pacified because his association was demoniac. Because of his demoniac association, he was a demon, although born in a very high royal family. A demon never cares for any good instruction. He is just like a determined thief. One can give him moral instruction, but it will not be effective. Similarly, those who are demoniac or atheistic by nature can hardly assimilate any good instruction, however authorized it may be. That is the difference between demigods and demons. Those who can accept good instruction and try to live their lives in that way are called demigods, and those who are unable to take such good instruction are called demons. So just a couple points I'd just like to make really quickly here. Prabhupada says here that he gives as a reason why Kamsa was a demon was that Kamsa was not pacified because his association was demoniac. Because of his demoniac association, he was a demon. So Prabhupada actually presents that as a reason why he was a demon, his demoniac association. So from this we can understand the importance of association. You know, Prabhupada's suggesting that just because he had that bad association, he was a demon. So in the same way, you know, Prabhupada was always, I heard one lecture recently, Prabhupada was making the point, he was saying, Tandera, he was quoting that's from the song by Narottam Das Thakur, Tandera Charana Sevi Bhakti Sanivas, Janame Janame Hoy Ayabilas. Actually, that was a lecture Prabhupada gave in New York, 1976, right around the time of the Rathayatra. He was lecturing from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And there was one lecture where he actually kind of gave his own purport to the verse, a song we sing every morning, Sri Guru Charana Padme. He went over it line by line. Anyway, at the end of that class, he made that point. He said, actually, the devotees, that's their only desire. They just want to Tandera Charana Sevi Bhakti Sanivas. They want to be in the association of the devotees and be favorably engaged in devotional service. That's all they desire, even birth after birth. So Prabhupada, you know, emphasized the importance of that good association. Devotees only want the association of other devotees and the opportunity to be engaged in devotional service. And that's almost like a reason why, you know, cause of being a devotee. If you're in that good association, that's going to really helped very significantly. Remain a devotee, be a devotee, and remain a devotee. And the opposite is true too. If you're in demoniac association, then you're going to be a demon. As Prabhupada's saying here, because of his demoniac association, he was a demon. And then right at the end of the paragraph here, Prabhupada says, those that can accept good instruction and try to live their lives in that way are called demigods, and those who are unable to take good instruction are called demons. And Prabhupada states in this text I refer to from the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the divine and demoniac nature, that's the only criterion by which one can say who's a devotee and who's divine and who's demoniac. I'll read the sentences. Prabhupada says here, one who does not follow the regulative principles as they are laid down in the scriptures and who acts according to his own whims is called demoniac or asuric. Prabhupada goes, there is no other criterion but obedience to the regulative principles of the scriptures. It is mentioned in the Vedic literature that both the demigods and the demons are born of the Prajapati. The only difference is that one obeys the Vedic injunctions and the other does not. So that's the criterion right there. And Prabhupada's making the point that if we keep the good association, we'll be able to, follow the injunctions that are presented in the scriptures. But if we don't keep that good association, it's going to becomes progressively more difficult, and at some point it's impossible. You're not going to be able to do it. That's why Prabhupada always emphasized, don't go outside of ISKCON. Stay within the association of the devotees. It was practical. It wasn't a sentimental thing. It's a very practical point that if you want to, remain a devotee, you have to stay in the association of devotees. You get strength like that. Prabhupada gave that example of the sticks. If you have one stick, it can very easily be broken. But if you have the bundle, then you can't break it. So in the same way, when you're staying in the association of devotees, it's like you're taking shelter of the bundle. And it's very difficult to you get strength from that. Okay, so reading on. Failing in his attempt to pacify Kamsa, Vasudeva wondered how he would protect his wife Devaki. When there is imminent danger, an intelligent person should try to avoid the dangerous position as far as possible. But if, in spite of endeavoring by all intelligence, one fails to avoid the dangerous position, there is no fault on his part. One should try his best to execute his duties, but if the attempts fail, he is not at fault. Vasudeva thought of his wife as follows, quote, for the present, let me save the life of Devaki. Then later on, if there are children, I shall see how to save them. He further thought, if in the future I get a child who can kill Kamsa, just as Kamsa is thinking, then both Devaki and the child will be saved because the law of providence is inconceivable. But now, some way or other, let me save the life of Devaki. That's the end of Vasudeva speaking. There is no certainty how a living entity contacts a certain type of body, just as there is no certainty how a blazing fire comes in contact with a certain type of wood in the forest. When there is a forest fire, it is experienced, this is Prabhupada speaking, it is experienced that the blazing fire sometimes leaps over one tree and catches another by the influence of the wind. Similarly, a living entity may be very careful in the matter of executing his duties, but it is still very difficult for him to know what type of body he is going to get in the next life. Mahārāja Bharata was very faithfully executing the duties of self-realization, but by chance he developed temporary affection for a deer, and in his next life he had to accept the body of a deer. Vasudeva, after deliberating on how to save his wife, began to speak to Kamsa with great respect, although Kamsa was the most sinful man. Sometimes it happens that a most virtuous person like Vasudeva has to flatter a person like Kamsa, a most vicious person. That is the way of all diplomatic transactions. Although Vasudeva was deeply aggrieved, he smiled outwardly. He addressed the shameless, so he's, really going to do the, he's doing it all right. He's just not only going to say the words, but he's preparing himself to deliver it properly in the whole works. He says, he addressed the shameless Kamsa in that way because he was so atrocious. Vasudeva said to Kamsa, my dear brother-in-law, please consider that you have no danger from your sister. You are awaiting some danger because you have heard a prophetic voice in the sky, but the danger is to come from the sons of your sister who are not present now. And who knows, there may or may not be sons in the future. Considering all this, you are safe for the present. Nor is there cause for fear from your sister. If there are any sons born of her, I promise that I shall present them all. I shall present all of them to you for necessary action. Kamsa knew the value of Vasudeva's word of honor, and he was convinced by his argument. For the time being, he desisted from his heinous killing of his sister. Thus, Vasudeva was pleased and praised the decision of Kamsa. In this way, he returned home. So it worked. It worked. And actually, this is a very important instruction here for preaching also, that, you know, Prabhupada states here in this previous paragraph, he says, sometimes it happens that a most virtuous person like Vasudeva has to flatter persons like Kamsa, who are a most vicious person. And Prabhupada instructed us, and Prabhupada says, this is the way of all diplomatic transactions. And Prabhupada instructed elsewhere that sometimes even preachers have to do like that. There was one predecessor, Acharya, who's more or less a contemporary of Lord Chaitanya, Prabodhananda Saraswati. And there's a very famous verse, which I'll never be able to remember, the Sanskrit starts, Dante, you know, where he basically said, Prabhupada referred to this as the preaching process. He said, you approach somebody, you fall at their feet, and you say, you know, you are such a great this, that, the other thing. Oh, yeah, you were taking the straw of the street in your mouth, which Prabhupada said, we don't do that anymore in one lecture, but that was the custom then. You take the straw of the street in your mouth, and you fall at the person's feet, and you flatter them like anything. And at some point, no matter how heinous or how, you know, puffed up a person might be, if you do like that, at some point they go, okay, what do you want? And then Prabodhananda Saraswati said, so then he would say, so just forget everything you know, and please just consider the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So, and Prabhupada went on to, you know, elaborate upon that point. He said, basically, flatter them like anything. And it really works. You know, it really works. Because, you know, we're in this material world, we're all trying to be the supreme enjoyer. And one of the main ways that the real supreme enjoyer enjoys, Krishna, is being glorified, you know, by his devotees, sincere glorification by his devotees. So we're trying to imitate Krishna, so the conditioned souls anyway, and they like that. People like to be glorified. And you'll find that you practically have to, that's my main thing on Sankirtan. I practically say, not that I don't want to, I'd love to say lots of things about the books to people, but it just doesn't work. They don't hear it. But what they do hear is flattery. My approach, the way I was distributing books on the Warp Tour, I was specializing on couples mostly, and this is what I do. The people, you know, once I get inside the showground, I just target all the couples, and when I see them coming, I say, guys, thank you so much for coming to the Warp Tour. You know, I was like I was some sort of official representative, and then I go, wow, you guys look. I was watching you. You guys look so happy. You know, everybody's wanting to be supreme and joyous. So you tell them what they want to hear. You guys look so happy, and they like that. They'd smile. Oh yeah. And then I go, yeah, you look like you're having such a great time out here. And they go, well, yeah, we are. We really, you know, look at you. Yeah, we are. We're having a great time out here. And I'd say, here, please check this out. This is yoga meditation. And then I'd ask them, are you guys a couple? And they'd say, well, yeah, actually we are. You know, these are all mostly the kids, 17, 18, 19. So I'd say, well, yeah, we are. And I say, wow, you look like such an awesome couple. You know. And that was like one, and I know it sounds a little corny, I apologize, but I tried a lot of different things, and that just worked. One couple, and that's all I have to say. And I'd say, please keep this with you. You know, we're monks. We're trying to make the world a better place to live. Everybody just gives a donation. That was it, you know. I mean, they couldn't, if I tried to tell them, show them the pictures about karma and this and that, and that would ruin it, you know. I just left it at that. I just ended up like, you know, any other thing I could think of to flatter them, you know. I just say that, and that was what worked. You see, so it's effective, and it's I don't feel bad doing that because I'm following the footsteps of what Prabhupada said and the predecessor Acharyas. You know, flatter them. Prabhupada's one lecture. Where Prabhupada said, flatter them like anything. So I remember that, and it's very powerful. It's very effective. You know, it really works. I mean, if you get somebody who is receptive, then by all means, give them a little philosophy. You know, only a bit. Don't make the mistake of, you know, starting a Bhagavatam class, or you can actually talk yourself right out of a sale like that. But just give them a teeny little bit if you can. But otherwise, just give them some what they want to hear, some sweet words, basically, and engage them. And let the book will do the rest. You know, they'll take that book home and they'll read it, and that'll take care of everything else. Okay, so reading on. Actually, what time am I supposed to stop? Finish. Okay, that's great. That was terrific. So I've got about halfway through. So whoever gives it tomorrow can finish the chapter. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Krishna Bhok Ki Jai, Janmastami Ki Jai.